Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Arnie Lukes here at the Crossroads, and I'd like to welcome Alan Moran. Welcome, Alan.
Hi, Annie.
No worries. Pleased to have you, Alan. I understand you've recently been travelling across to go to a seminar or something overseas, and I'm keenly interested in your report. So you've got the floor.
Yes, I went to a meeting of an organization called the Mont Pelerin Society, which was actually in California. The society was formed just after World War II when the prevailing view around the intelligentsia, if you like, was that socialism is the coming thing. There was an increasing role for world government, and that we really ought to be talking about a different sort of property right from that which had been evolved throughout the free markets. The group met, actually it's called the Mont Pelerin Society because they met in Switzerland. In Mont Pelerin, which is a major mountain there, and essentially they evolved a series of meetings, usually annually, to address particular issues and to actually form the sort of political agenda, the kind of blueprint about what a good society would be and how much superior free markets based on property rights and various things, institutions like the family, etc., would be in terms of prosperity and in terms of economic freedom. And basically, they evolved and they met in these various occasions year by year. And in the first years after World War II, there was that kind of march of socialism, and it was brought to something of a halt by two politicians who were very much in line with the Mont Pelerin views, and many of them knew the leading lights. Many of the leading lights knew these two politicians, Thatcher and Reagan, of course. And it led to then a review of how we ought to downsize government. And there was quite a lot of deregulation. There wasn't really much. There wasn't really much in terms of downsizing of the budget, but we saw less government interference and control, and that brought a period of considerable prosperity in the West. And of course, that prosperity coincided with the growing sclerosis, if you like, of the Soviet model and its total collapse by 1990. From then onwards, it was then declared a victory in the Cold War, victory for capitalism, if you like, free markets. Oh, socialism. But one of the things that we've seen over recent years is the creeping back of that socialism and communism. I think you've described it in one way, which is the centralization, the United Nations having this United Nations being controlled by elites and seeking to control national agendas and national economies. But even without that, we've seen this newfound socialism come through, and especially in the more recent years. In fact, if we're looking at the two of the three leading candidates in the U.S. Democratic Party presidential elections, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, are pretty well what we would have called communists not long ago. Indeed, I think Sanders really does call himself that sometimes. And we've also seen in other countries a growing increase in socialist takeovers in Latin America, for example. Until recent years, the model was Chile. Chile was the fastest grow had been the fastest growing country. It had, even though it was under a dictatorship, at one side says it had totally deregulated its economy and was achieving growth rates of 6 or 7% a year, which was unheard of in Latin America. And most Latin American countries did follow suit then. But we always had the outliers, and Cuba, of course, being one. But then Venezuela, which adopted, it had been the, I guess, well, the third most prosperous country in the Americas after the U.S. and Canada, and with massive oil reserves, etc. And that 10 or 12 years ago decided it was going to take a socialist route and nationalize a great many of the industries, the oil industry, and have punitive taxation levels, which were redistributed. And of course, now we've got to the situation where Venezuela has dropped from the fifth most prosperous to just about the least prosperous country in Latin America. And not only has it failed as an economy, but it's become the normal sorts of dictatorship that we've seen in the socialist world, with people being arrested and for their views, etc., and not being and the elections being fixed. So we've got a situation where there was this triumph, if you like, over socialism in the 50 years or so post World War II. And it's sort of coming back a bit. You've got a lot in the American agenda, a lot of people saying, well, this system isn't working for us. And they back it up by figures. Some of them are kind of spurious, but the system is working insofar as just about every income strata has seen increased living standards, increased income in real terms over the past 30 years. But the relativities have moved somewhat. We have seen the richest saga get richer and the poorest saga not get poorer, but not get as rich. And this has actually led to the politics of envy. And in some degree, it's creating a bit of a crisis in capitalism insofar as that there are more voices now calling for more government control over the way we live and the way we interact and the way we spend our money than has been the case for a great many years. And this is leading to quite severe changes. And I mentioned Venezuela, but Chile, which was the poster child in Latin America of free markets, is now more almost in a revolution. Started about an increase in metro fares, but suddenly became people on the streets demanding higher pensions and more equality and control of the factories and whatnot. Is a serious situation. So we've got a sort of a crisis of capitalism, which has come on to us in the Western world. Meanwhile, the Eastern world, if you like, in China in particular, which was of course communist, but India, which was very, very much a controlled economy and a failing economy until 20 years ago, have very much liberalized the way they operate, and the government's controls have been lifted in China and India, and led to these great successes. China, of course, is rivaling the United States in terms of the size of its economy, but of course, in terms of the per capita incomes. And India has been growing quite impressively over recent years. Uh-huh. So we've got this dichotomy going on. The Western world, which led the way in terms of developing free markets, has seen these decay somewhat over recent years, and a disillusionment in free markets, perhaps spuriously there, but nonetheless there. And at the same time, you're seeing the more rigid economies and which were poverty-stricken economies have actually developed a greater amount of the free market facets and basic formats, and are prospering as a result. So there is that kind of dilemma being addressed in organisations like the Mont Pelerin Society.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting report, Alan. And I think I was thinking of the meaning of words in what you were saying, because the liberal democracy, liberalism, laissez-faire, to me are a sort of an individualistic orientated type of point of view. And that is, I think it would align with something like, say, Jordan Peterson's dominance hierarchy, where people will aspire for the top and they'll actually achieve getting to the top. I see it as something that's sort of orientated towards Darwinism, if you like, survival of the fittest type thing. And I get concerned about it in a sense, because this backdrop we've got, which is the actual... gauging Watergate at Griffith in New South Wales. I took a photo of it, I think it is. And they're actually suffering at the moment because of, if you like, the exploitation, not of just a little bit, but actually the whole nation, the exploitation of the price of water. I noted in the press the other day, it talked about if we had turned one river inland, then we would have a sufficiency and the price of water wouldn't be exploited against the whole nation. Now, I'm suggesting that in a, if you like, a laissez-faire perspective, a whole nation can be actually seized upon for an opportunity by, if you like, an individual or even a small group of individuals. And in the case of our water increasing 500%, to me, that's a very good example of how individuals making profit can actually hurt an entire nation. The cost of water, the cost of food, or if it's the cost of energy up 200%, then it's the cost of all industry, and that has to affect every single family. So to me, the idea of laissez-faire, while it sort of presents itself as freedom, in actual fact, it's an opportunity for individual exploitation. I know this is a different point of view than yours, and I respect that, and I acknowledge that it is a different point of view. But to me, it's very important to look at the, if you like, the social consequences of policy, and if that, if an individual getting ahead can hurt a whole community, a whole town, a whole nation, then surely there needs to be a, if you like, some sort of reins placed on them. Your thoughts, Alan?
Well, I mean, there are. There's certainly, if an individual getting ahead means the individual exploits the demand for a product and is able to then jack the price up, that's something that almost has always been laws against that. And we have the ACCC and various institutions here with laws against that. The case that you're talking about, though, isn't individuals. I mean, it's many individuals. I mean, that it's not operating as a monopoly. They're responding to the fact that the demand for water is very high at the same time as the government has actually reduced the supply of water to irrigators by insisting on an increasing amount being fed into environmental uses, which depletes the amount available to irrigators. And the smart people, if you like, people are smarter than us too anyway, have seized upon that and said and estimated that is actually going to create a higher price for water. So they bought up the supplies, and lo and behold, the price is higher. They're not exploiting it insofar they're not exploiting it in the sense that you mean, that they're supplying the water. They're not taking the water away or exporting it anywhere. They're supplying the water to farmers, to those farmers who will pay the highest price, just like anybody does. And I don't see that as in any way an area for condemning laissez-faire. It's basically an area for condemning government intervention into the marketplace and restricting supplies at a time when demand is very high. And those people who are making money from it, well, they're basically offering their asset, which they now that they own, the water, to the people who are prepared to pay more. I mean, how else would you do it? You could say, well, we could have a tally board of who are the most worthy people, and you and I would top that list, I'm sure, and we'd get our water supplies, and a tally board of people who aren't worthy, and they wouldn't get theirs. Well, we see that sort of thing with the present kerfuffle with the sports minister, who's magically allocating funding for sports clubs to those who happen to be electing National or Liberal Party members. I mean, and that's the kind of allocation you get if you don't use the price system.
I see a slightly different take on that, Alan. And it's actually in one of the documents that you've brought up. You talked about the incomes across America, and you highlighted statistically within those incomes that the middle class, if you like, the middle strata, is actually has significantly lost ground to the higher strata. The middle class, if you like, I call them, if you use them, I'm going to use it a now, what's it called? It's an emotional term, kulaks. I'm going to call them kulaks, the middle class. And in America, the kulaks, the middle class, are actually losing ground significantly. And I might put it to you that the middle class in Australia, those irrigators, those farmers, in the end, the people who buy the food that comes from the water, they're losing ground significantly, to the detriment of those, if you like, in the higher strata, who are actually taking advantage of increasing the water as a commodity, as an essential commodity. They're increasing the price of water 5 times. I agree the government policy is wrong, but I also highlight that the former merchant banker, Malcolm Turnbull was responsible for designing this policy. Conservative government calls themselves conservative, nothing like it. He's, in my view, he is definitely a liberal, definitely laissez-faire, and definitely trying to exploit
No
it.
laissez-faire about Malcolm Turnbull, except insofar as it supports his policy. Malcolm Turnbull has transformed markets. He created the situation whereby energy, you mentioned energy, and water were taxed, or various forms of energy and water were taxed in sort of way, in ways that actually benefited him or his family businesses. Essentially, that's not laissez-faire. Is where the government actually holds the ring. It has the law, it administers the law, and individuals then work within the law. When the government becomes the law and can change the law to meet its own members' preferences and interests, then you have forms of socialism. And Malcolm Turnbull was archetypical socialist in that respect. He may have been a merchant banker, and there are many more like him who are merchant bankers worldwide who are pursuing the same goals. I mean, one of the UK firms, banking firms, it actually subsidizes, pays money to the Extinction Rebellion, for example. Where these people then target energy firms, target firms who are thinking using too much water or too much whatever, creating a crisis for these firms. This merchant bank then buys them at distressed prices and then sells them off. So it's actually using extra legal, paralegal people to actually undermine laissez-faire by exerting sort of political pressures and making a profit from it. That is basic. That's not only is it not laissez-faire, it's downright banditry, in my mind.
I look on, well, I guess definition of words is important. Laissez-faire to me isn't government. Laissez-faire is uncontrolled capital. And if you like, socialism or communism is uncontrolled government, both being totalitarian in their end position. And I see, and it is interesting because I see in the education institutions, both sides of the same coin, totalitarianism, are presented. Both sides, whether it's in the Marxist socialist side, or it's in the monopoly capitalist. I call it laissez-faire. You may call it something different, Alan, but I see the monopoly capitalist and the socialist communist as being both totalitarian, whereas freedom for the individual, is completely foreign to both those methodologies, both those philosophies, if you like, though both those points of view, Alan.
No, I don't agree. I think laissez-faire basically means you allow competition in there, and you allow for, General Motors dominated the motor industry for many, many years. Toyota dominated. It looks like Tesla's going to dominate it in the future. That could not be possible under communism. The state rules things, and it doesn't allow competition to come in there. Whereas our system, it allows it to come in. Now, there are special circumstances where natural monopolies are put in place. People would have referred to the Rockefeller monopoly at the beginning of the 19th century as being one such circumstance. Whether it was or not, the governments broke it up into many different firms, so they did compete. The laissez-faire there is basically firms offering their services, offering the goods to consumers, and facing other firms offering similar goods or even different goods, and having to do so in ways that meet the consumer's needs most efficiently and at lowest cost. And that is what's driven the standard of living. That's why we have a standard of living like now and not like in the 15th century.
I see. I guess to me, I'm reading, I'm listening, and thinking of the descriptions, the adjectives you're using, and I see free enterprise as being some of the descriptors, if you like. They could actually fit into the category of free enterprise, but not necessarily monopoly capitalism. Those are two different points of view. I agree with free enterprise, and I think the idea of providing a service to the community at a fair price and returning you for a profit, I think that's a good thing. But when it becomes encroaching, when it actually is essentially designed for confiscation rather than for the best thing on the market, or if you like, what is overall best for the community, I think these are different points of view. Water is an illustration. Power is an illustration. You mentioned Rockefeller, and we go back to the time of Malcolm Fraser, world parity pricing, and of course we suffered greatly at the cost of fuel being driven through the roof. Now, it wasn't that long ago. What was it? Fuel was like $1 a litre. It's now $1.70 on a bad day, and world parity pricing has helped to bring it up there. And the thing is that the production of oil, as just as another example, the price per barrel is back to those days before Malcolm Fraser, and yet the price of fuel is nothing like it. And that to me is exploitive. You don't get it back. Once it's taken from you with these monopolies, you don't get it back. Your thoughts, Alan?
I'm not really sure that. I mean, the price of fuel, in terms of petrol, I mean, has been dominated by major players who are monopolistic or have some sort of monopoly. That's OPEC, and the price of fuel was driven up as a result of that. It's actually been undermined, that high price, by laissez-faire, that is, and shale oil in the United States, basically a new form of production. The United States is now, again, I think, just about the biggest producer of oil in the world, which he was last in about 1954, as a result of innovations there. And that's basically reduced. You don't hear much about oil prices anymore. I mean, they're no longer $5 a barrel, but they're basically, they've risen to a level of whatever it is now, 50 or whatever dollars a barrel. But they went that high because there was a shortage, and that shortage led to new discoveries being sought and new means of tapping them, the oil being found, and which is the fracking and other productive methods.
That's right.
So, there is no monopoly producer in the United States. There are thousands of producers, thousands. I mean, and the fact that these are very nimble and always looking to reduce their costs and exploit market opportunities and various niches in the market has kept the price of oil lower than, much lower than it would have been. And indeed, oil is just about the only commodity where you can say there is a potential for monopoly. That, it's the only commodity where, a major commodity, where you can say, well, the price has gone up five or six or sevenfold over the last 30, 50, 40 years. And that's because of a special situation which we had in place, which was initially broken by the Saudis and others who quadrupled the oil price in the 1970s and then increased it further after that. And has been brought back in check by the developments of oil discoveries elsewhere, and especially the new means of tapping oil through using shale oil,
That's right,
and
yeah.
that all small companies.
Yeah.
So I don't. I see that. I understand your point of view that there's exploitation, and that, I mean, you mentioned a fair price. I mean, that always rings bells with me. A fair price, what does that mean? Because you and I have a different view what a fair price is. I think in terms of market price, that is the whole constellation of buyers and sellers coming together and a price evolving from that. And if, and you, we're talking about the water situation, if it suddenly something happens, that to the supply, that is, the government cuts off a huge bunch of the supply, then the price is going to soar, and that will happen whenever either the price soars, or you have to have a benign dictator, which would preferably be you or I, who allocates it to people who are most worthy, and quite frankly, even the most benign dictator, in my experience and my reading of history, and yours too, I assume, turns out to be a despot and
That's right.
start murdering people.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not even sure that people like Lenin and Stalin were necessarily that bad men when they first came into power. But the basic need that they had to control everything meant that they had to shoot people who either relinquish that control or shoot people who were standing in their way. And
Yeah.
we that with this appalling situation that occurred there.
Yeah. I my understanding of oil and gas, it's interesting you talk about those producers, but in actual fact what they are is drillers, and they control up to the wellhead or the distribution network. But refineries nowadays, in Australia, a lot of refineries have been shut down, and there are huge refineries in Singapore and areas like that. And the thing is that most of the, if you like, the opportunity for increased added value is owned by giants like it used to be Exxon, Esso, Standard Oil being the original parent company for Mobil, Esso, Exxon, Texaco, Caltex. And all of these, of course, are coming back under the same umbrella. Anti-monopoly laws disassembled it. But the thing is that these refineries in hubs like Singapore, where the oil gets shipped to, taken out of the wells and shipped to there, and then produced, that's where the markup occurs. So the exploitation, the monopoly is still there. And I look on the, if you like, the distribution of water, which is our principal subject. There's no reason why we can't increase supply. There is no physical reason. It's just a political will. Do we wish to increase supply? And then the price of water will come down. And
Exactly right.
the fact is that there's no one out there who's beating that drum, certainly not in the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, because then they would lose their power. And of course, if you're a bureaucrat or a politician, you survive based on power and nothing else. This is your end
Exactly.
position. It really is insidious. Alan.
I think that's right. I mean, looking at the oil situation first and their analogies between the two, as you correctly point out, the fact is, can you imagine somebody saying, we're going to build $1 million a barrel oil facility in Australia? The Green Groups would be out, it'd be 10 years before it got off the ground. You want to do that in Singapore? It goes straight away. So what happens then? Well, these facilities, where do they set up? You're going to set them in Australia? Are you kidding? They know they'll have pandas and koala bears all over the place, stopping them doing anything. And you have a government which is impotent to stop these radicals from preventing us earning a decent living. That's not there in Singapore. They would be allowed straight away, and therefore they have these massive facilities. We don't have them. In the case of water, well, as I say, there's two aspects. One is that the government has positively reduced the amount by 20% of water, and that's created this dreadful situation. The other is that I mean, there's many schemes, and there's one going back called the Bradfield scheme from way back in the 30s for turning the waters from the north south and augmenting the supply of water to the irrigated areas of northern Victoria and New South Wales. The thought that somebody might have a plan to put this into production, I can just see the myriads of hurdles that would be put in their place by government to prevent that happening. I can see that, you know, and whereas in China, for example, they had a Three Gorges policy, they did it and they put it into place. Now you might say that they kind of rode roughshod over some communities and bought them out at cut prices or whatever. But you know, they basically said that this is somebody said this is needed. We can earn a profit, didn't quite put it like that. We can grow more food. We'll do it. In Australia, I mean, people keep talking about it, but nobody's put a shovel in the ground. Nobody's got a concrete plan yet. And that's partly because, you know, the impediments, the bureaucratic and political impediments to doing it would be so severe that it'd take you a lot longer than you thought it would take you, and it'll cost you a lot more money. You look at the we've gone through this process with a coal mine, a relatively simple coal mine, Adani. 9 years, 9 years of going through the bureaucratic obstacles, and it would have gone even further. It would have never gone ahead under a Labour government. You know, the 9 years. Can you imagine somebody from either somebody who wants to invest in Australia from overseas, or even an Australian wants to invest? They look at that and think, "Wow, that is adding a huge transaction cost to my proposal," and you know, if it's taking 9 years, probably doubling the cost of the proposal.
I've got to actually bring something up, Alan, and I guess it's because of my insider knowledge within oil and gas, and that is that Santos built off of the coast of Queensland, built a liquefied natural gas plant, and I understand that there is actually two more built on the same piece of land. New Guinea has built a natural gas plant, and of course we've also got the natural gas plant at Karratha in Western Australia. And most of the gas that goes to directed to these five plants are for export, and that's five gas plants. Now they've been constructed in the last 15 years. These are all relatively new installations. In fact, I think that the Santos installation was just starting when I left when I left that company. And so that was, say, 6, 7 years ago. And the thing is that these were given a big tick in the box, environmental ticks in the box, and they weren't actually stopped. And I put it to you that that if you like, the financing of the particular activist groups is actually coming from vested interests. And I know that's a separate subject, but I believe it's an important subject for us to consider, that activist groups, environmental groups, can actually do the bidding of other companies. I'm going to just make that statement, and I'll give you an opportunity to respond, Alan, and also your closing thoughts. Thank you.
Well, I think you're probably right. They are companies, will finance or will give tacit support to groups that close down their competitors. And the fact is that the government allows them to do that. And we can see it now where people are saying, "Oh, well, nobody will ever build a coal mine anymore because
Absolutely.
The environmentalists." Well, if I've got a coal mine, that's quite valuable to me, but nobody's going to be my competitor. So. Yeah, good luck to all those people who are stopping the Johnny Come Latelys coming, who might undermine my prices and harm my particular shareholders. So the government ought to do something about that, that's for sure. In terms of the amount of oil, yes, there's a lot of gas exported, but I mean the real tragedy in Australia is the stacks and stacks of gas. You cannot even look for it in South Australia, Victoria, Tasmania, or New South Wales, and it's just been opened only the last few weeks in Northern Territory. So we have a gas price, which the gas price say is at $2.50 a gigajoule in the United States. Our prices long was that kind of level. It went up to 10. It's down a bit more since then. But the only reason is that nobody may look for gas. So we've got tightening supplies of gas, the stack of gas, both for export and for local. The price here ought to be pretty much the same as in the United States. They export their gas as well, but the price in New York is $2.50 a gigajoule, and it should be that price in Victoria and in Adelaide. But the reason why it isn't is because governments have been spooked by activists who say, "Oh no, gas is going to harm the planet, or it might hurt some earthworm or whatever it is," whatever spurious reason they want to do, they have prevented people looking for gas, and therefore we have less of it available.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent summary, Alan. That my take on it is that the activists may at least be doing the bidding of someone else, and I think that really, really is important. Thank you so much, Alan. I'm going to cut across and just do a quick spiel on some websites. Now, this is the Mont Pelerin Society that Alan spoke about, and I'll also make a point that the Murray-Darling Basin Authority is actually calling for submissions, the Senate Select Committee, into the constitutional alteration. And I just wanted to highlight that that's actually current until at least the 6th of March. Alan's webpage, Regulation Economics, and a couple of his articles recently in The Australian, and this other article that's here. And I think that that's really, really important. And I noted, I'll come back out of that because that's probably enough. I don't need to talk about Scott Morrison because that's only going to distract from more than enough topics in one day. Alan Moran, this has been beaut. I've really enjoyed the banter and to discuss different points of view. Thank you so much.
Terrific, Arnie. Good program.
No
Thank
worries.
you.
Good on you. Bye bye.